You ever step back from a case you're watching or really anything in life and just go, wait a second, let me just take a broader overlook here. Let's do the 10,000 foot overlook of what this all looks like. Sometimes when you do that, you get a different perspective. Sometimes you're just really close to things and really into kind of only microscopically seeing this stretch of your view, because that's what you're focused on, that you lose sight of all of that, everything else. So that when you see it way far out, you're like, wait a second, I'm over here. This kind of feels right, but I see it that way. Maybe I should look at this differently. I'm not here to try and sway anyone one way or another on the case of Karen Reed. You are all entitled to your own opinions. I'm just going to break down some facts of the case in chronological order of what you would have to believe if the story of John O'Keefe getting beat up in the house is correct. This has actually nothing to do with Karen Reed, because that whole story, I don't think it has anything to do with what happened that night. I don't think it even happened, especially with what we're about to go through. But you can still believe Karen Reed is innocent, or that Karen Reed didn't hit him, or that there's a reasonable doubt that Karen Reed killed John O'Keefe without believing any of this. You can. You can still support Karen Reed without believing that land. That land's very divisive, if you haven't seen by now. I just want you to know that. Because I think it's a lot of times you get stuck in this way or that way, and that's it. No, let's just take a look, okay? Let's rewind for a second, not to the courtroom, not to the 911 call. Let's go all the way back to the beginning of the night. It is January 28th of 2022. It's Brian Elbert's birthday weekend. A group of friends, family, and coworkers, including Karen Reed and John O'Keefe, head out to the Waterfall Bar in Canton. These aren't hardened criminals. This is your average suburban social circle. Teachers, police officers, parents, professionals, people who RSVP to cookouts, people who Venmo each other for youth hockey raffles. They're drinking, they're laughing, they're taking selfies. There's zero tension in the room, by all accounts. Text, photos, surveillance, everyone's having a good time. There's hugging, there's smiling. Karen's taking videos, John's in the mix, no fights. Jennifer McCabe claps when she sees John and Karen arrive because she's happy to see them. There's no bad blood here. This isn't Casino. It's more like Cheers with slightly worse lighting. Later that night, a smaller crew heads over to Brian Elbert's house for the after party. It's cold, snow is on the ground, but inside, the vibe is still light. We know people were watching the Celtics game. Someone literally played It's Raining Men on YouTube, and there was a teenage girl sleeping upstairs. This isn't a frat party. It's not even a rowdy bender. This is a low-key post-bar hangout among adults who've known each other for years. Now, here's where the defense invites us to take a very sharp left turn. Within the totality of all of this, this normal beer and basketball atmosphere, the defense theory suggests that someone or something snapped. That somehow someone or several someones or everyone made a sudden unspoken decision to beat John O'Keefe unconscious inside the house. Why? We don't have to come up with that answer. Just they did it. Just believe they did it. No one ever says why. There's no clear motive, no history of tension, no buildups, just a hard cut from, hey, what's the score, to let's murder this cop and dump him in the front yard. To believe this version of events, you have to accept that a group of otherwise stable, law-abiding adults went from talking sports to dragging a dying man out of the house without missing a beat. Agreed in the middle of their friend's birthday to kill someone they knew and quietly stage it outside like a twisted snowman. And they did all this while continually casually hanging out with music playing, texts flying, and no one calling for help. That's not just a plot hole. That's a massive psychological rupture. It requires you to believe that the human nature broke down completely over the course of an Uber ride home. It means ignoring that John O'Keefe was a well-liked man, taking care of his niece and nephew since his family had just passed away, and trying to be a good dad. He's well-loved. He's well-respected. He doesn't seem to have any enemies. But suddenly he's enemy number one in this whole house, or at least some people in this house, kill him, and then everyone agrees. We're not going to say a word. None of the guests, not one, seem to notice anything is wrong. In fact, texts from the party afterwards show people saying how fun the night was. Nudge, nudge. How fun it was to kill John, right? See it bowling. One person even called Karen Reed a great person in a message sent hours after John was supposedly killed in the house. You'd have to believe they all just switched modes from celebration to homicide, from friendly to feral. Like they all caught some spontaneous case of social murder psychosis. And then after allegedly committing this brutal act or watching it be done, or hearing it be done, they cleaned up, posed the body in the front yard, and coordinated a multi-agency cover-up so cleanly, not a single person cracked, not one. Not during police interviews, not during federal agent visits, not under media scrutiny, not in group chats, not even by accident. So yeah, if you're still with the defense theory at this point, buckle up, because what comes next, it gets even dumber. You're at a birthday party. You got leftover bar fries in your stomach. The Celtics game is on TV, and someone just queued up It's Raining Men like it's 2006 or 1986. Now, the defense theory wants you to believe that in the middle of that, the laughing, the drinks, and catching up, someone says, "Hey, guys, what if we kill John O'Keefe right now?" And everyone just agrees. No hesitation, no pushback. Just the entire group of adults, most of them cops, spouses of cops, school staff, deciding right there in Brian Elbert's living room to commit felony murder. Because nothing says birthday party like beating a guy to death while your niece sleeps upstairs. So you got to believe that. And then there's Chloe, the German Shepherd. That's been turned into a co-defendant by Reddit. According to the defense, Chloe might have attacked John inside the house, or maybe outside, or maybe both. We're never quite sure because there's zero physical evidence of a dog attack. No blood in the house, no fur, no claw marks, no eyewitness, no dog DNA. And when Jennifer McCabe ran inside the house to wake up her family, she testified she didn't remember seeing the dog at all. Not because the dog wasn't there, just because she wasn't focused on Chloe when she thought someone was dying in the yard. Go figure. But don't let that stop the theory. Chloe is still somehow the only witness who hasn't contradicted herself, mostly because she doesn't talk. Now it's time for cleanup. After allegedly killing John inside the house, the group decides to drag him to the front yard in plain view of a residential street, one with neighbors, security cameras, and snow on the ground. They don't take him to the backyard, not a car, not the woods. They walk right out in the front, put him under a flagpole, and just leave him there. What does that look like exactly? Was someone like, "Hey, hold his legs while I get the arm"? Did they cover the blood trail with glitter? No one's saying, because there's no footage, no forensics, no one on record saying they saw anything remotely like that. And yet we're expected to believe this is the real scene of the crime. There's the Google search, heard round the world. Ah, yes, the 2:27 a.m. Google search, How's Long to Die in Cold, the defense's crown jewel. Jennifer McCabe testified that she searched it because Karen asked her to, while panicking about whether John could survive the elements. The problem, the search timestamp before the body was found. But again, prosecutors pointed out, and digital forensic experts agree, those from Cellbrite who actually interpret the data, that this can happen if the browser tab was already open. They don't timestamp new keystrokes. They log session opens. And McCabe herself said she was just trying to help in a moment of panic, not conduct a covert research op. And then he demonstrates it in court on how it can be done. You ever leave a browser tab open? Open it up at night, go to sleep, do another search in the morning, you never like bring up a new tab? Guess how that gets logged on phones? Or at least it did at that point in time. But if you believe the defense, she deliberately Googled that phrase hours in advance to plant digital evidence on herself. Because nothing helps a murder cover-up like typing the motive into your own search bar. And then we have the perfect conspiracy, featuring literally everyone. To make this theory work, dozens of people, family, friends, cops, neighbors, teenagers, a German shepherd, would have to lie to police, never text about it, avoid slipping up under cross-examination, coordinate interviews, and maintain all the same story for over 2 years. Even mob crews have rats. This theory requires you to believe that a bunch of people who can't agree on what snacks to bring to a cookout somehow executed a perfect, undetectable conspiracy in a few hours, all without getting a single drop of blood on the hardwood floors. Meanwhile, Jennifer McCabe says Karen Reed, standing next to John's body, screamed, "I hit him, I hit him, I hit him." And again, she told police she said every variation of this. Could I have hit him? Did I hit him? I hit him. I hit him. I hit him. Oh my gosh, could I have hit him? That's likely what took place. And it makes total sense if you're trying to run things through your mind. It's a little weird she was doing it before she even got to the scene and knew John was dead in the yard. There's that. And she's already admitted on tape. Yeah, I said I hit him. But did I really say it as much as the media makes it out to be? I think I'm paraphrasing slightly. I might have said like the or the or something off. But that's Karen on tape. And she's already said 1,000 times, could I have hit him? Did I hit him? It's not a crazy stretch to think she said that. And it's not an omission. I don't think she knows what happened. But something brought her back there. She knew exactly where to go, exactly where to look, where you couldn't see anything in the snow. Does it mean she murdered? I don't know. I think it could just be a fleeting memory. Or putting pieces together, if that's the last place I saw him. I do not know the answer to that, and I don't know that there's enough reasonable doubt to convict her. But the trial's not over yet. Starting to think there may be. She told police, she told prosecutors, she told the jury. The defense says she's lying. She made it up. The entire thing, the quote, the 911 call, the panic. It's all fake. All of that, it was all acting. You believe that, then you believe the entire night, the entire house, the entire town turned into a murder cult at 1:30 in the morning. And then just got up and went back to work on Monday. And if you believe all that, okay, tell me where I'm wrong in the comment section. Or seek help. I'm kidding, kind of. Tell me what you think, seriously, in the comment section. Just back it up. Because this is, I don't know. It seems very cut and dry to me. At least in that story not being legit. It's not cut and dry as far as if she hit him or not. There's still questions there. The biggest question, though, I think is, does she remember it? How did she know? How did she have that inclination, that intuition of, did I hit him? And she's asking that to the girls before they get to the scene. Of course, you could say, well, that's all lies. That never happened. Except Karen says it did, too. So, yeah, there's that. Again, comments, tell me what you think. Press subscribe, too, if you're listening to the podcast, wherever it may be. And, hey, check out our YouTube channel, if you're already there. Hi. Comment, subscribe, check out our polls. We got all that stuff going on. We got a lot of stuff there. So please do subscribe to both. I'm Tony Bruschi, and we will talk again real soon.
Craving nonstop true crime updates? Press subscribe now and get the latest cases, analysis, and expert commentary delivered straight to your feed. Only from the Hidden Killers podcast and True Crime Today. The neighborhood was picture perfect. Manicured lawns, kids riding bikes, friendly smiles exchanged over white picket fences. And then there was him. The guy who never made eye contact. The one who only left his house at night, dragging black trash bags to the curb. Bags that sometimes twitched. He's just a little odd, they said. Just keeps to himself. Until the smell started. Until the missing pets turned into missing people. Until someone finally had the nerve to peek inside that basement window. And if they had only subscribed to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts, they could have listened to Hidden Killers with Tony Bruschi ad-free, and before everyone else, they could have recognized the warning signs. They could have gotten out, but they didn't. And now, they're part of the next episode. Don't make the same mistake. Subscribe now to True Crime Today Premium Plus on Apple Podcasts.